I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock, and we have Matt Leonard with us from the well-known and respected California activist group, the Rainforest Action Network, known as RAN. Matt is a campaigner for their global finance campaign. Hi, Matt.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
Okay. Well, it's good to have you. So, Matt, we're talking about Wall Street today. Can you give us a little bit of a clue how a Rainforest Action Group ends up dealing with Wall Street bankers?
Sure. I work on a campaign called the Global Finance Campaign. It started in the year 2000, basically after doing a lot of work trying to stop a lot of destructive rainforest industries and sectors by going to the source. We were working with oil companies or logging companies one by one and realized we needed a strategy that would be preemptive, that would actually stop a lot of these projects and a lot of these industries from going forward into those regions in the first place. So we decided to look at structuring a campaign around the Wall Street, around the financing that enabled all of those projects to move forward. And from that point, we started to work with a number of Wall Street banks to develop more comprehensive policies that would guide their investments and their clients and advisory roles, specifically in regards to rainforest regions. After a few years of working that, we developed a number of comprehensive policies with some banks. International level, and then we've kind of gone back to the table, focusing on climate issues, and working with banks to take the policies they've previously adopted a step further and start addressing much broader climate concerns with their investments and their choice of clients.
And I understand RAN did get some wins out of this. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. In 2004, we've been campaigning on Citibank for a number of years. And worked with them to draft a policy at that time was actually a very strong policy regarding their work in threatened ecosystems, specifically around some forestry issues and working in indigenous communities. A number of banks followed suit after that. We also played a role in the development of what's called the Equator Principles, which is a similar set of guidelines that several dozen international banks have signed on to that address their role in what's called project financing. So specifically bring some guidelines into play when that financing is happening that cause them to look at the human rights and the biodiversity and ecosystem impacts of those projects and that development.
Well, you're sitting at the table with some of the power brokers. Does that mean the group has given up protests and actions?
No, absolutely not. Quite the contrary. We pursue what we like to call as an inside-outside strategy. We're very much a grassroots-led organization that works with a lot of effort on the street, so to say, using everything from creative grassroots tactics and street theater to even nonviolent direct action and civil disobedience to put these issues on the table of some of the world's biggest corporations. But we also try to keep one foot in the negotiating room as well, so that the policies that are being drafted are having some guidance from organizations like ourselves that do actually have a very crucial perspective to bring, rather than allowing corporations to draft their policies in a vacuum and perhaps end up with less meaningful policies on the ground.
Well, I guess there's no use just standing out on the sidewalk saying you're not listening to us and then not talking to them. You really have to.
And sometimes, they aren't listening to us. So it does take a lot more of that work on the sidewalk to get to that point. But I take a personal philosophy that if they'll sit down at the table with you right off the bat, you're not asking for enough.
Well, I want to move on a little bit to the climate problem. I'm thinking about the glut of public wealth that's about to be given away in the proposed emissions trading schemes in the United States. It kind of makes my stomach turn. Various levels of governments are cheered on by the big investment banks. They say they'll just give away these carbon licenses to the biggest polluters for free. That could be a bonanza for them, bazillions of dollars in new tradable wealth. It could even be the start of a new trading bubble to replace this subprime mess. Why can't we auction off the rights to the public air or just spend the money directly on renewable energy?
I'm with you. I think we should. There's a huge trend right now of carbon trading and emissions trading programs that is largely being looked at what's happening in Europe, where they have the European Union emissions trading scheme. And as we're searching for ways in the U.S. to find some sort of substantive climate policy to reduce emissions, a lot of people in the industry are pointing towards carbon trading as this a silver bullet solution. But unfortunately, the history shows quite the opposite, where what's been happening in the European Union over the past few years is billions upon billions of dollars of windfall profits for the dirtiest polluters and for the banks that are involved acting as brokers in those permits and that trading, but very little, if any, emissions reductions are actually happening. And I firmly believe that carbon trading could go one of two directions. It can be windfall profits for the worst polluters and privatizing our atmosphere in a way that you and I, Alex, have no control over, or a way where we can actually look at climate policy as a way to really reduce emissions at its core and invest that money for the public good rather than for private profits.
Well, you know, the Wall Street Journal for March 13th has a front-page story about an economist who, quote, strikes gold in the climate change fight. And the article has a quote from Robert Stavins, an economist from Harvard. Stavins says, "The only way we can fight climate change is if there is an opportunity for businesses and individuals to make a fortune off it." What's your reaction to that?
Well, I think it's absolutely true. We do need businesses and individuals to take a role in fighting climate change that isn't one that they're doing out of an ethic or a mindset of guilt or of charity. It needs to be something where they see the benefit in it. But I don't believe that benefit and that motivating force needs to be one of windfall profits. And unfortunately, a lot of industry analysts look at carbon trading as being a potential sector worth trillions of dollars. And that's a sector that is clearly set up to allow the actors in it to be the world's most, some of the biggest corporations and the biggest polluters, and not be any sort of even notion of a free market at all. People like you and I certainly have no way to be able to trade in that market. It's only going to be utility companies or automakers or manufacturers that are the ones who created this mess in the first place.
Well, that's part of my point. I think, you know, the biggest American investment houses like Citi and Merrill Lynch, they were supposed to set some sort of global standard. Instead, they turned out to be the biggest con men in some ways. Banks in Europe and Asia and people all over the world were sold CDOs that now turn out to be worthless and other supposedly AAA-rated stuff. So my question is, how can we trust these same Wall Street people to set up the new carbon market? How are they going to honestly rate which emissions are real and all that?
I agree. I don't think we can. I think we can look at the history of emissions trading and carbon trading and see who the winners are and who the losers are. And fortunately, the loser has been the climate and communities, and the winners have been banks and multinational corporations. I definitely think that we need to look at other options for reducing our emissions that are going to be much more effective and also much more equitable in terms of what that money goes to and from and who it's going to support.
Well, all the mainstream media, the bobbing pundit heads, all agree on one thing. We can't have direct government action to save the climate quickly. Oh, no. They call it command and control. They call it Stalinism or something. But when it comes to the amount of time left to prevent catastrophic climate change, the scientists that I talk to say we're approaching the finish line, and it's not a nice thing at all. Maybe we have 5 or 10 years to yank down our greenhouse gas emissions. So what the heck can we do to keep a habitable climate system on this little planet?
Well, I think action needs to be taken from every sector and every corner. But there are definitely a handful of some major steps that can be taken right now in the short term. And one of those is specifically what our campaign works on, which is trying to stop the development of coal-fired power plants. Coal is the leading cause of greenhouse gas emissions across the globe. And there's currently, at least in the U.S., there's a major expansion of coal-fired power plants being proposed. And Wall Street, of course, is lining up to finance that. And also in your neck of the woods, or somewhat in your neck of the woods, across north of the border, is the Athabasca, the Alberta tar sands, which are also largely being touted as a way for the U.S. to get off of foreign oil reserves, but also an incredibly environmentally destructive and climate-destructive practice. And looking at declaring some sort of moratorium on both those industries would be a great first step towards addressing some of this the climate crisis we're facing.
You know, I ran last week an interview, or actually it was a speech by Obama, Barack Obama, and one of the questioners was a man from Americans for Balanced Energy Choices, and I looked that up, and it turns out they paid CNN $5 million for ads in 6 of the Democratic presidential debates, and the ads say coal is clean and good and we'll all die in the dark without it. And I'm wondering, who are these coal lobbies? Who are the people who really want to make a killing, literally, out of climate change?
Well, ABEC, it's funny you mention ABEC. We actually refer to them as Americans for Bogus Energy Choices. But they are a self-acknowledged front group for the coal industry. They've got roughly a $40 million budget from major utilities and coal mining companies, basically fighting a propaganda battle, trying to convince politicians and public that some new technology that has made coal suddenly clean is within our grasp. Unfortunately, when you actually get down to their arguments, there's very little substance there. The fact is, coal is not clean from its entire life cycle, from extracting it and coming out of the ground to transporting it to finally burning it in for our power plants. It's definitely the dirtiest fossil fuel known to man, and it's certainly something that the technology just doesn't exist to make it clean. They've done an amazing PR battle, but people aren't buying it. People are looking at who's funding ABEC and where that money's coming from and rejecting that for being outright lies.
And where do the Wall Street firms stand on this? Could you name some of them and how you would rate their sensitivity to this coal financing?
Sure. Well, our campaign currently has been focusing on Citigroup and Bank of America, which are two of the largest funders of the coal rush, both here in the U.S. but also around the globe. And we're in fairly regular dialogue with them about it, and they're seeing coal as being an increasing concern. And actually about 2 weeks ago, a number of banks got together and released a document called the Carbon Principles, which perhaps more aptly could be called the Coal-Fired Power Plant Principles, but basically creating a set of guidelines to guide their investments and their lending to utilities that are building coal power plants, recognizing the huge concerns they have with the immense CO2 emissions from these power plants, but also looming federal regulation that'll be presumably coming down the pipe and with the new Congress that will make carbon-intensive industries such as coal power plants extremely expensive and extremely risky investment. So while banks aren't saying no to coal yet, they're certainly putting those balls into motion and recognizing that the future of our energy cannot rely on a finite fossil fuel that's destroying our climate and killing communities, but that we need to look to clean, renewable energy sources for the future. And that's the smart investment that we're trying to steer banks towards a little faster, but they're getting there one way or another.
Well, you know, here in British Columbia, we just instituted a carbon tax. It's the first in North America. Do you think that can help out?
Absolutely. I think one of the biggest problems right now is that we have been essentially polluting our atmosphere for nearly a century, and there's no cost to that. It's an externalized cost that doesn't have to be factored into the cost of mining or burning coal or pumping oil. And one strong step in that is putting a price on carbon and making our economy and making these companies account for that, rather than putting that into the atmosphere and, you know, letting other industries pick up the tabs for the health impacts or the climate impacts from that, their actions. The American Lung Association here in the U.S. Estimates that 24,000 people a year die from coal-fired power plants, from the pollution, the particulate matter, and from asthma and respiratory diseases. And those are things that that's a cost that should be covered by companies that choose to burn coal, but they're able to externalize that and not have to deal with those emissions. And unfortunately, the public, you know, picks up the tab for those things, and the hundreds of thousands of cases of asthma or respiratory disease. And the carbon tax is definitely one way to start doing that.
Well, it seems like Americans, at least in the past, get a rash all over when you start talking about a new tax. California, I guess, has started its own carbon market. It's back to the cap-and-trade game, and BC has joined that. Canada's just announced they're going to form their own. Is there any way to counter this tsunami of big-money propaganda telling us emissions trading is the only way to go?
Well, I think, you know, actually the actions that, you know, BC just did with implementing a carbon tax are very promising. A carbon tax is definitely something that is gaining some political momentum here in the U.S. Unfortunately, the T word is something that's a bit scary to a lot of politicians, and they don't want to utter it. But I think that momentum is slowly changing. And specifically in California, we do have actually a fairly strong legislative mandate to reduce carbon emissions. It's called AB 32, Assembly Bill 32. And as you said, cap and trade is one of the leading proposals for how to reduce those emissions, but it's certainly not the only one at this point. And actually, just this past month, a number of groups representing the California environmental justice community signed a huge declaration, a 20-point declaration declaring opposition to carbon trading and looking to push much more effective measures as a way to combat climate change.
How can we find out more about that online?
There's a great website called EJ Matters. It's Environmental Justice Matters, and it's got the declaration on there and all the signatories of which Rainforest Action Network was one, and a bunch of great little fact sheets looking at the implications of carbon trading, both historically as well as what it means here in California.
I'm talking with Matt Leonard, a campaigner for global finance for the Rainforest Action Network. You know, Matt, one of the fascinating aspects of your group to me is the marriage of old-style California radical politics and the sophisticated ability to reach these big financial players. So are you a tree hugger who carries a briefcase or what?
Sometimes. I try to avoid the briefcase when I can, but I certainly recognize that we have to recognize social change happens at a lot of different levels. And it's important that we both are able to say no to what we want, what we don't want as communities and as people, but also being able to recognize a lot of the decision-making and structures of power that exist in our society and how we can influence them to bring about the change we want to see. And sometimes that may mean chaining yourself to a bulldozer or hanging from a tree, and other times it may be putting on a suit and working to hammer out a policy that will be meaningful on the ground.
Which is worse?
It's a good question.
Well, Rand gives me some hope we can still have some impact as citizens, even if we aren't as rich as Ken Lay. So how can people find out more about the Rainforest Action Network, and is there a way for us to help you fight off any pirates in ties?
Absolutely. We can check out our website, which is www.ran.org, R-A-N. You can sign up there for all sorts of email alerts and action alerts of things that our campaigns are working on. And certainly, you know, what's happening with the expansion of coal-fired power plants or tar sands in Canada, there's lots of ways for people to get involved wherever they're at around the country. If you've got a Bank of America or Citigroup in your backyard, you can help organize a protest or flyering or demonstrations there. You can go in and cancel your account and let them know why you're canceling your account and switch your money over to a bank that has stronger ethical standards. You can certainly get involved with local efforts if there's a power plant being proposed in your backyard or a pipeline expansion or it kind of depends on where you're at, but you can certainly come to our website and get some more information for ideas to take action.
Well, that's Matt Leonard at ran.org. I'm Alex Smith. This is Radio EcoShock, and thank you so much, Matt.
Thanks a lot, Alex.
All right.